The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I want to talk a bit about mindfulness of perception. And it's a very important topic, the idea of perception and what perception is and the value of paying attention to it. And a couple of analogies that you might know of. The one about the person who went around the countryside barefoot and then ended up getting his feet cut up. So the person went to the monarch of the realm and asked to carpet the kingdom, the queendom, with leather. And some minister said, no, that's inefficient. Why don't we just put leather underneath everybody's soles, everybody's feet, and have shoes? So the place of contact, where we actually touch the ground, that's what you want to protect, not to cover everything. The other example is that of the old days when there were walled cities. If you wanted to know what was going on in your city, you could wander around with a clipboard and wander around the streets and alleys and knock on doors and kind of take an inventory and find out who had come in and who had come out. And you'd be up in the north end of town and someone would slip in the south end of town and, you know, you'd miss them in the alleys and, you know, it'd be hard to find everyone. But if you had one gate going into town through the walls, and if you had a gatekeeper who was there, everyone who comes in and out of town has to go through the gate. And so it's a lot easier to know who's coming and going. It's also a lot easier to decide who gets to come in and out, because the gatekeeper's job is to decide who gets to come in and who gets to come out. So when the wild dogs from the neighboring town wander over, it's a lot easier just to keep them from coming in the gate than it is to try to round them up after they've come into the town. And then if you have some really nice, something really nice, beautiful, clean, well-tamed, well-trained dogs in your own town, and the gates open, then those wonderful dogs you have might wander out and become the wild dogs. But you have a gatekeeper who says, no, you stay. We would like to keep you here. It's useful to have you. So the idea here is that where we pay attention, what we pay attention to is very important. And if we could pay attention to the place where the juncture, the interface where we meet reality, there's a lot more discovery and understanding of what comes into our life, what affects our lives, what we bring out and what we do into the world. And we take much more responsibility and care if you're right there at that juncture, that contact point. It's kind of like there was to be like a hourglass, and all the sand has to go through the neck. But so you can track and count, maybe in theory, you know, all the things that pass through the neck. But the hourglass of our minds and of our society is huge, infinite perhaps. So if you're going to try to track everything going on in your own mind, you're going to spend at least a lifetime doing it, and then you won't exhaust it. And if you try to understand everything about the society, you want to be safe in our world and understand everything about our world out there, it's going to take more than a lifetime to learn everything. But if you learn something about that, you know, the neck where between this infinite mind and infinite society, that's where you can kind of not only take care of yourself, protect yourself, know how to be in the world, but also where you can discover freedom by paying attention right there. And so perception is close to that point of contact. The point of contact in Buddhism is called the point of contact or touch. So when we see something, it says that the object of sight touches the eye in a way, and so there's sight. We touch something with our hand, and so there's touch, there's physical contact. There's the contact of odors against our nose, sounds against our eardrums, and taste against our tongue, and also there's the The contact of thoughts, for example, against the mind sense, the mind perception, there's contact there. And that's pretty basic. And then there's something that happens. That's the gate. And it turns out, you know, some of these wall towns have the gate, outer gate, and then have an inner gate. And the inner gate for us is perception. There's a second gate where you can watch. And perception is not, in English, sometimes we talk about perception, we think that we are innocent perceivers, and we see something and we see it exactly like it is, and you know, that's how it is. But the word sanya in Buddhism, perception, is what we make of what we see. We're not innocent in our perceptions. We are constantly interpreting the data that comes in, for example, through our eyes, and reconstructing it in our mind. I find it a little bit confusing that they tell me that my eyes see everything upside down. That's what they show, these wonderful diagrams in the physiology books, and they show, you know, that somehow the light gets crisscrossed in the lens and it gets projected onto the back of the retina upside down. Isn't that confusing? So what are we seeing? You know, should I be standing on my head to see accurately? Or so what happens is that the brain reconstructs it, you know, and we have this tremendous reconstructive process in the brain where we reconstruct the sense data that comes in and make some sense of it. And, you know, and we think it's accurate enough. I remember I read many years ago, I read a book about the, I think it was about the Bush, they're called, back then at least, they're called the Bush people in Africa. They'd spent their whole life living in the jungle and kind of, and had a whole society there, never been outside. And then some researchers apparently took them out of the jungle to some of the great plains of Africa. And they, for the first time in their life, they looked out across the plains. Never had had that kind of distant horizon to be seen. And far off in the distance, there were elephants. And they had known elephants, because sometimes elephants came into the jungle. So they knew what elephants were. But they never seen them outside the jungle. And so those bush people were looking and said, wow, out here in the plains, look at those elephants. They're the size of ants out here. And they didn't know how to perceive depth perception. They didn't know how to interpret it because apparently they'd never had anything that far away. And because in the jungle, everything's kind of close by. I mean, that was the book said. So, you know, they didn't know how to reconstruct, understand through depth perception. We think that's, you know, an obvious thing. And so what happens when we perceive, sometimes we see through a filter of our concepts and ideas of what we're looking at. Sometimes we call it a projection. We take our ideas and concepts and values we have and we project it onto what's there. Whether it's a filter or a projection, maybe that, I don't know which metaphor works the best, but I like the metaphor of that we're painting our reality. We're constantly painting it. We have an active role. And I saw that most clearly when I first went to the Zen monastery at Tassajara. There was something about going there and being there in the first weeks that heightened my sense of attention of what was going on in my mind and around me, that somehow I became acutely sensitive to the fact that I was, you know, when I looked at a tree, you know, I wasn't just looking at the tree, I was painting tree-ness on the tree. I had an idea of tree that somehow was being kind of painting a veneer, a kind of overlay on it, kind of like you would have a projection on a blank screen. I mean, it had some basis in reality. The oak tree was there for sure. But there was a feeling or sense inside of the active mental activity of constructing the tree-ness going on in my mind. Sometimes it's much clearer when we see people. Especially, I remember when I was 18, I went to Morocco, and it was the first time I'd gone to a non-Western country as a kind of an adult. And I found myself, after some while, week or two in Morocco, finding a certain kind of ease and relaxation in my mind that was unfamiliar to me. And I thought, what's going on in my mind that I feel is a little different? And after a while, what I determined was that the people in Morocco back then, 1972, were still, men were wearing the yalabas, those gowns that they were wearing on the streets, and the women, I don't know what they were wearing, traditional clothes. And all the usual concepts with which I judged people in America weren't relevant there. Back then I was 18, I was a hippie, and they were the jocks, they were the straight people, they're the Republicans, they were the, all these people, right, who I could put into categories very nicely and I had feelings about them and everything. But in Morocco, I didn't have any of that. It was completely outside of my domain of usual categories, and so I wasn't doing it. And that not doing it and just seeing without that extra little filter was actually relaxing for my mind. And so, we have filters like, oh, that's a dangerous person, or that's an attractive person, that's a person I can get something from, that's some person I shouldn't, get too close to, that's, that person's too much this, too much that, whatever, Look at those clothes, look at that, and this means that whatever, someone wears, I have this Puma socks, right? Isn't that nice? It must mean that I'm a runner, so now everybody's like, oh, Gil's a runner. The rumor spreads across the country, Gil's a runner. And so then, you're sort of seen through a certain filter, we have a certain role, and it makes clear that people are seeing us in the role when we don't want to be seen in the role. We've left the role at work, and we don't want to continue having the role when we go to the party. And so so people are perceiving us or painting us, overlaying us, that you're that kind of person, you're that kind of role. And we do that for ourselves as well. We perceive ourselves. We have concepts in which we overlay ourselves. And so some of those concepts have to do with the past. I'm still that kind of person in some ways, and so I can't let people know who I am because they'll find out who I really am. Or they better know what I did, 35 years ago. Let me tell you what I did 35 years ago. So they say now, it would have been 43 years ago. I was a really special person. I went to Morocco. Now, you get that? You understand how special I am because I went to Morocco 43 years ago? I mean, it's ridiculous, right? Holding on to who I was. I think I would recognize myself if the 40, 18-year-old Gil showed up here. Who's this guy? Strange guy. this idea that we're still somehow the person we were is a perception. Buddhism would call it a perception. Because the word that we translated into English, the Buddhist word we translate into English as perception, could also be translated as the label. Or the very simple rudimentary concept we have about, of the experience. And so, and these concepts are fluid, much more than you realize. I don't have it here, but you have this bowl, this bell, that's next to the soundboard there, big bell. And, right now it's a bell. We used to have one that was a little bit bigger than that, that looked just like that, the same kind of knocked, kind of rough edges and all that. That was a traditional Norwegian storage bowl for kindling for the fireplace indoors. So that could easily be used for kindling. And I've used it to conduct lotteries. It's a lottery bowl. I put put names in, that's what we use for lotteries here. When we take names out of a hat, we use that lottery bowl. Or my teacher in Burma, he used a spittoon. And that's a perfect spittoon because it's big and wide enough that I can probably not miss it too often. What would you think of me as a teacher? What's your perception of me as my teacher if I was... uh, I mean, you know, in some cultures, I guess it's fine. Maybe, you know, but here, I think that my status as a teacher would probably decrease, and fewer people would come here, especially if I had it right in front of me. Depends on my aim. People would be sitting far away. or there was a bell, like Brian, right in front of Brian. Can you lift up that bell? So it was just bell, just like that, but more beautiful. It was clearly a Japanese, beautiful Japanese bell that I saw what I assumed was a homeless person in San Francisco using it as a begging bowl for money. And I thought, after I saw it, I should go back and buy it because it looked like a really good Japanese solid bell. So is it a begging bowl? Is it a bell? Is, you know, they have monastics in Asia will eat out of bowls. Is, you know, is it a, you know, could be used for that, could be used for cooking, it can be used for your soup, you know, it could be used for a doorstop. There's a lot of things, And so we call it by what we use it for. And so the label often has to do with its functionality. Is that inherent in the thing, or is it, or is it something we apply to it? And of course, we often overlay it. But then we confuse the functional perception, the functional concept we have, with reality. We think this is what it really is, and so then we kind of aren't protected, you know. And so, for example, we have these bells. They've been here for a long time, and this is in our meditation hall, which is a functional definition, perception, meditation hall. But it's a sacred place, and so by association, meditation is sacred, so the bell must be sacred. So we have to treat it sacredly, and if someone decides to turn it upside down or fling it across the room or use it as spittoon, you know, it kind of rubs against our sense of this is, no, it's not that. This is a sacred bell. And then we can have little sacred wars. You know, the bell. You know, and then people are, you know, they're disrespecting, you know. It's just, you know, it's just a functional thing. So, you know, whether my examples are the best ones, I hope you're forgiving, but the idea is for you to hopefully make your own examples that are better. But so we have these concepts. So Buddhism, the word sanya refers to not pure perception, but rather what we make of our perception. And in fact, some scholars will argue that Buddhism does not posit the possibility of pure perception. A pure perception means that you can actually, your eyes or whatever your organs of perception are, can see accurately what's there without some role that your mental life has in organizing that, reconstructing that, interpreting that, putting a label on top of it, or something like that. And some people are a little bit troubled by that because they feel that there should be pure perception, and it's kind of a drag to have labels for things and concepts. But it's not a problem inherently, and the point is not getting rid of concepts, but the point is to become free of them, to not be burdened by them, not suffer because of them. And that's part of the task of practice, is to become wise about how we use concepts. And the wiser we become about them, the wiser, the easier it is for us not to have concepts that we suffer under, that we live under the weight of them. And so some of the concepts and perceptions have to do about ourselves, and a tremendous amount of suffering can happen about how we see ourselves. We suffer because of how we see others. We cause others to suffer because of how we see them. So part of the task is to become wise about the perceptions we live under. So, for example, if someone asked me, who are you? Innocent enough question. And I could say all kinds of things. And so I could say that I'm a person who 43 years ago went to Morocco. And you better not forget it. Thank you. And that's, you know, I'm trying to help you with your constructions so that that gets embedded really deep, imprinted deep. And so now, from now on, you'll see, when you look at me, you'll say, look, that's that guy. You know, so that's who I am, you know. Or I could say that I'm the person who failed my high school chemistry class. And that was 45 years ago. And, and so that's still carrying that idea. That's who I am, you know, this person who failed this class and being weighed down by that. And every time I get near a chemistry book, I shiver and shake. If I tell you who I was now, who I am now, based on what I was a long time ago, you know, is that interesting? Who are you? I was a person who was hungry this morning. You know, did that really tell you who I am? What's that about? It's about the morning, not now. Who are you? I could tell you that I am Norwegian. Does that give you important information about you, about me, and is that important? Could I say that I am a man? I'm 61, and you know, is that how I'm beginning to define myself in front of you? Is that really that interesting? Maybe it is important in some circumstances, because functionally it has some role, all these different things. But I could carry this with me as kind of a fixed way. This is who I am. And it can be a heavy thing. So if someone decided that, you know, so I say, well, I'm a Dharma teacher. That's fine for now, but I better not be a Dharma teacher when I go home tonight. I have three people at home who would not appreciate me showing up. The Dharma teacher's home. I'm ready to give a Dharma talk. Sit down. So I could say I'm a Dharma teacher now, but that's just, you know, it's a situational thing. But then one of you could say, well, that's fine, but, you know, the latest research has shown that Dharma teachers who wear blue shirts are no good. And so, oh my God, what am I going to do? And, you know, blue shirts, and now I'm being seen, you know, as a blue shirt Dharma teacher, and this is embarrassing. And there's a whole drama that begins arising in my mind because someone is, so then I see myself now through the filter of being this blue shirt Dharma teacher, which is not good. And uh-oh. So it's very, you know, it's a simple concept. It's a filter, a projection that we have on top of it. It's fascinating in this regard, you know, who are you, that the Buddha would sometimes refer to himself as being thus. Who are, it's kind of like someone would say, who are you? And he would say, I'm thus. That's not a lot of information, is it? Is that helpful? Thus, such, I'm such, I'm thus. Here, you get what you see. I'm just like this, kind of like this. So that's not, maybe it's not very helpful. It's not helpful functionally when you want some information or you want some skill or you want something to done. When you know, if you have a plumbing leak, you know, and you ask people, you know, everyone here, what are you? And maybe some of you are plumbers, right? But everyone, I'm thus. you know, water spilling out of the toilet onto the floor. And, yeah. So there's functional definitions that are useful, but there's something very profound about saying, I'm just thus. To not have a label, to not be anything, to have the capacity to just kind of be, not need to be anything. One of the titles for someone who's fully awakened in the Theravadan tradition is Akinshano. And Akinshano means no thing. Someone who has has nothing. Now, nothing is, if you're a nothing and a nobody in English, that's bad news. But there's a way in which in Buddhism that there's a freedom in that, to not have a label, to not be not have this projection or this filter that's constantly weighing us down and covering us over. So part of the mindfulness practice and meditation practice is to learn to be present enough for our experience right at the gate, right at the as things arise in the moment, so we can begin seeing the roles of concepts, seeing the role of these perceptions that we have. And sometimes you'll see that the filter of perceptions or the conceptions that you're using are very abstract and almost disconnected with the reality now. To say, I'm a person who went to Morocco 43 years ago, and that's supposed to give you a real sense of who I am today, I'm offering you an abstraction. I have no idea what it means for you to think, you know, a person went to Morocco 43 years ago. There might be a range of opinions and attitudes about that, what that means. And so then we're talking about abstractions, and I have one idea what it means, you have another idea of what it means. It all becomes kind of mushy after a while. And so we can watch and see the nature of the kind of ideas that we live under. Are they grounded closer to what's happening here and now, or is it in fact an abstract painting that has nothing to do with what's going on? Some of you know the story of a Chinese painter who was painting a realistic tiger, I think it was, or dragon, and then stepped back, you know, a few feet to look, you know, been working really close, stepped back to look at what had been painted, and got frightened and ran away. So some of us, we're all master painters in the head, right? We paint these scenarios and abstract ideas of futures and pasts and presents. And, you know, the fish gets bigger every time you tell, you know, the fish you caught gets bigger every time you tell it, right? So we tell these stories about our past, and, you know, they're not necessarily accurate, our past memories, because we tell ourselves stories. And so we get frightened, or we get excited, or we get enchanted by these stories we tell. So part of mindfulness is see how this works. And if all you're doing is letting go of your thoughts, then you lose the opportunity to see in a very simple way what projection, what perception you're operating under, how abstract it is. So you take a moment to notice, oh, this is future thinking, this is past thinking. Oh, this is present moment thinking. This is present moment thinking that has its flavor. This is a concept. Some, you know, you're sitting here meditating and someone comes in late when the sitting's already started, and they come in and you hear the door click when they come in. So one perception is, oh, there's a click. Another perception would be, there's the click of the door. Another perception would be, someone's coming into the building after the sitting starts. Another perception would be, here comes a disrespectful person coming in late. They should know better. And if they have to come in late, they have to be really silent, no clicks. That's another perception, right? And then it can be, you know, there's a person coming in late, disrespectful, one more time, and the people who run this meditation center are not really running it in a strict, firm way, and rules that say none of that. And we need to, you know, I have to write a letter to the president of IMC and explain that this meditation center is lousy. I'm going to Yelp it and give it one star and explain they let people click the doors. So you see the layers and layers that go on, right? And so what happens when we sit and meditate and the mind gets quieter and calmer and more mindful and more focused, some of the grosser levels, layers, which are very active activity in the mind, begin to calm down. And calm down, and it's kind of become, can become like, you think of it kind of like a reverse order from the order I talked about, until finally you get down to some of the more basic levels. Click, click, door's closing. Click, someone's coming in after the sitting starts. Leave it at that. you know, it might be that click, someone's coming in late and they're being disrespectful and everything. And then you find out that it's a good neighbor who's come in because someone in here's car is about to be towed away. And they thought, yeah, I should go in there and ask if someone, you know, parked their car in some neighbor's driveway, and would they like to come out and get it before they have to pay $400 to get it out of the tow company's, you know, lot. And so someone who actually wasn't disrespectful, actually a person who was caring for us, came in late. And so, you know, we don't know the story, right? We make cars are closed, we make a story. And sometimes it's not an accurate story. So we calm down. And then it comes at some point, this interface, where we can start noticing the difference between what becomes an abstract story that maybe is true, maybe not, but is kind of a constructed of our mind, and what is really based on reality. Click probably is based, it's a click. Click of the door, it's probably a pretty good guess that that's what you're hearing. You can hear the direction of it and all that. Click in the door and someone's coming in late because you hear their footsteps. It's probably accurate enough. Click, footsteps, someone's coming in late, and it is, and then you fill in what it is, what it means. And that you begin saying, oh, you don't know. You don't know what it is. And you can actually have the clarity to see that being born in your mind, this story. And you have enough clarity to see that it's a story in your mind that you can put a question mark after it. Maybe. Maybe until I have more data. But let's not get too excited. Let's just keep it as kind of hypothetical. And life is a lot easier if you can see it as a story that you have to get more data to find out if it's true. Imagine if the, you know, it was a neighbor who was caring and wanted to save some people. You know, it was coming out of generosity and care and goodwill about the car being towed. And, you know, you turned, you know, the person came in and said, very quietly, say, psst, you know, does anybody here have this blue Honda out there? But before the person had a chance to say it, you know, someone here turned and said, be quiet. The poor neighbor, right? I mean, you know. So the interface is very powerful. There's a lot of, that's where freedom can happen, because if we latch onto the story, then we're not free. But if we see it as a story and let it be, then we're free enough maybe to find out, is it true, or to take a second look and find out differently. So the mind can go from gross abstractions to less and less abstract, more and more simple, all the way to some simple, very simple, oh, it's a click of a door or something, that simple. And as it becomes this way, the act of thinking, that is a perception, is a label, becomes lighter and lighter, thinner and thinner. It becomes something that has no momentum in the mind or weight in the mind, or we don't invest a lot of authority in it. And so we don't hold it in this big, solid way. And to have our perceptions, our view, our concepts occur in this very light, soft way makes it a lot easier to leave them alone, to not get pushed around by them, to not pick them up, it makes it a lot easier to put a question mark next to them. Let me look more carefully and see what's going on. So part of what we're trying to do in meditation is to get things quieter and quieter, softer and softer, calmer and calmer, so that we can start seeing the nature of perceptions, nature of these projections, these filters that we put on top of them. And then part of the wisdom part of Buddhism is to recognize that the objects that we perceive are empty of our projections. They're inherently empty of the projections. So when you say that's a bell over there, but that's a functional concept that it's a bell. It could be something different. And so it's empty of my projection of bellness. doesn't live there inherently in it. Or this room here, we call this a meditation hall now, but the room is actually inherently empty of meditation hallness. It used to be a church sanctuary. We could turn it into a dance hall. In a month or so, we're going to have a play here, and it's going to be a theater. It's going to be all these chairs lined up here in a row, and that'll be the stage up there. And luckily, we're not doing a play now, so otherwise we'd all be looking at you guys and expecting you for song and dance. But it's not. It's just a meditation hall today. But there's nothing. There's no inherent meditation hallness here. So we have a projection. We're painting it, and it's a collective painting. We're all sharing it, doing it together today. Thank you. But it's an empty of our projections, and this idea that so much of our reality is empty of our projections is meant to be a freeing perception, a freeing realization in Buddhism. And one of the ways of understanding freedom that I find very meaningful is that it isn't that we become free, because if you have the idea that I am becoming free, it's not that different than saying I went to Morocco 43 years ago. But rather, I think it's more useful to say that with freedom, we grant freedom to everything else. Everything else becomes free from the weight of our projections. Isn't that nice? And our friends become free of us. People become free. So we have such a self-centered approach to life oftentimes. And so that I'm going to become free. When am I going to become free? You'll never be free. But you can give infinite freedom to the world around you. And that is what counts the most. So perceptions, the word is sanya in Buddhism, very important word. And it's our playground, the playground of perception. I hope you enjoy it. So that was my thoughts for today. And thank you for coming. It was very nice to have you here. And as I often say these day-longs, one of the best things that IMC offers is these silent day-longs, because it really gives people a chance to really practice on their own and, negotiating the path, negotiating the practice really on your own, without a lot of input, is really kind of the heart of where the path opens up. So having these days and having people like you come for the day is very meaningful, and I'm also confident that each of you that came offered your presence as support for the others. And so it's not easy to do this kind of stuff and all day long, and so we do it together in a mutual support system, and I appreciate all of you coming and offering yourself this way. The custom here at IMC is that the people who practice here are the people who take care of IMC, so on a volunteer basis. And so we asked for about 7 volunteers at the end of the day to help with the basic tidying up. Takes about 10-15 minutes to clean the bathrooms, the kitchen, and sweep the floor out there, maybe vacuum this floor here. Are there about 7 people who'd be willing to stay after 1?